There are haunted houses, and then there are very haunted houses. Houses where something almost always happens in the middle of the night or the middle of the day. Houses where the spirits are extra restless and extra active, and the dead outnumber the living. Today, we speak with Reverend Gerald Hunter, author and paranormal investigator, whose incredibly haunted childhood home shaped his entire career. Would you have been able to sleep in the house he grew up in? Listen and decide. Today, on Homespun Haints. Hello, Hainted Loves. Welcome to Homespun Haints. I am Becky.
And I'm Diana.
And today on the show, we are thrilled to bring on the Reverend Gerald Hunter. He is an author. He is a paranormal investigator. He's a retired minister. And he has some stories.
Oh my goodness. Get ready for a part one, because there's going to be a part two.
In fact, Jerry told us so many ghost stories that we couldn't even fit them all into this episode. So our patrons will get to hear the rest of the stories later this week. If you'd like to become a member of our Patreon and get those extra stories, along with all episodes ad-free, we would love it. We would be so honored if you would join our Patreon at patreon.com/homespunhaints.
So many stories.
You're going to love this episode. So buckle up, buckaroo. There's a lot of ghosts coming your way. And he's also just a genuinely amazing person to talk to. So you're really going to enjoy this. He's great. And what is not great is what happened in my house on Friday.
That was a very smooth segue. I liked it. I approve. Continue.
Continue. Yeah. Well, we were just talking about our cats. And as you all know, I have two. I have the COVID kitten, who's no longer a kitten, grew into a ginormous beast that we named Ripley, as in Lieutenant Ripley from Aliens. We were told she was a cat when we got her from the pound, but I kind of feel like Lilo in Lilo and Stitch being told I got a dog and got an alien, because nothing about this creature is cat-like. And then we have Prozac cat. We have Ella, who is also a rescue cat. We got as an adult, and we have been attempting to give her Prozac for years now, because up until Ripley grew into a giant bear, she was trying to eat Ripley. So as a result, this poor cat has some PTSD, or bear, or whatever you want to refer to this creature as, because you've seen her, Diana. Oh. She's the size of a medium-sized dog. Mm-hmm. Very heavy. The vet keeps telling me she needs to lose weight. I'm like, don't put your body image issues onto my cat. She's fine. She's beautiful. I'm not even sure she's a cat. So this cat better be thankful she's so cute, because she has destroyed so much property. Again, she's like a dog. She growls at the postman. She plays fetch, and she destroys things. For those of you that have dogs and are not cat people, cats don't eat shoes. They don't rip up carpet. They're supposed to be pretty mild-mannered things that, like, use the toilet and otherwise just kind of lay around and give you smug looks.
They rip up upholstery, which is why you have a corset chair now.
That's why I've been
reupholstering. They rip vertically as opposed to dogs, which rip horizontally.
So this cat dog that we have has caused about $20,000 to $30,000 of damage in the last month.
Oh, geez. In 1 month. That's a record.
Well, that's what we think. It could be longer, but we're going to feel like terrible parents if it happens to be longer. So here's the thing. This all began in January. We had somebody who was cleaning the house. I was away, and her boss sent me a text saying, could you please have your son stop peeing in the trash can? I was like, my son doesn't pee in the trash can. And she sent me a photo of the trash can in my son's room filled with urine. I was like, oh, that's so embarrassing. And of course, I confronted my son. He was like, no. And I was like, maybe it was one of your friends. So we're going through the list of like all of his friends that it could have been.
The conversations that you have as a parent. Okay, make a list of your friends. All right, now which of these friends did you leave alone in your room long enough to pee in your trash can, and which one would actually do it? Well, Mom. Right.
No, my son completely defended his friends. He was like, my friends don't do that. And there was a part of me going, it was probably the cat. But I'm trying to, like, envision the cat propping up. This is a big cat.
And a female cat, so she's not spraying.
Female cat propping herself up on the tiny little ledge of the trash can so it doesn't fall over and filling it. And this was a lot of pee. It was not a one-time thing if it were a cat. And my husband and I are like, nah, couldn't be. So we actually asked the cleaning lady to throw the trash can away, and then we gave her a very hefty tip. So then we think problem solved. Mm-hmm. And then we noticed a dark stain behind my son's dresser.
Oh, no.
And we thought, oh, maybe one of us went in there and spilled coffee. But it got bigger. It was mostly under the dresser, so we didn't notice it. It was just like a little bit that we could see.
Oh, no. And
finally, Friday night, I don't know why, but my husband pulled the dresser away. That cat apparently had been perching up on her little forepaws against the back of the wall and peeing down the back of the dresser. And it must have been happening ever since we took the trash can away.
Well, yeah, you took the trash can away. That's where she pees.
Oh, man. I spent all night on my hands and knees with a box cutter removing carpet. It was all the way down to the subfloor. It was moldy. So now we have to replace all of the floors, because if you're going to do one room, you might as well do everything because it's connected. And then the stairs also need to be replaced, but we were going to wait until we had to redo the floors because you have to be at the subfloor in order to do the stair rails. So now we have to do the stairs, which means we also have to do all the landings. So one little scrap of moldy carpet is causing an entire house remodel.
It's a good thing you love cats.
I gave that cat the stink eye for a few days.
That was her punishment. You glared at her.
Well, she is really cute.
I mean, what do you do? The cat doesn't know. You can't, like, the whole, like, rub your face in it thing. That doesn't make sense to cats. They don't get it. They don't understand what's going on. They just get mad at you.
I saw her. Again, we were trying to figure this out. Like, how did she manage to get it all over the floor under the dresser, but she didn't get the wall and she didn't get the back of the dresser? This takes incredible aim for a 30-pound cat. And then the other day I saw her using the litter box, and sure enough, that cat poised like a ballerina on a tightrope on the edge of the litter box and went. I was like, she can do it. Oh.
Okay. So no excuses now. You got to toilet train that cat. It's easy to toilet train a cat. The thing is reinforcing the behavior so they actually want to do it as opposed to peeing on the carpet. But now you've got the perfect excuse because your cat can already perch on the edge of a thing that doesn't have any kitty litter in it and pee into a bowl. If she does that anyway, it's time. It's time. You have like a lot of bathrooms in your house. You could totally do this. You could dedicate a bathroom to just cat pee. You can still use the toilet, but during training, it's good to have an actual kitty litter bucket inside the toilet so the cat can pee in there.
Yeah, I remember when you did this in your apartment and it was your only bathroom.
Yeah, that was rough.
So we all had to pee in the kitty litter when we came to visit. That was weird.
You know, Becky's replacing her entire top half of her house because of this cat peeing in an inappropriate spot. And is she going to do anything about the cat peeing in an inappropriate spot? Or is it going to happen again?
Okay, I will toilet train my cat. She already knows how to activate the bidet. She likes to drink out of it.
This is going to be a challenge. Okay.
All night long, we hear the water squirting. And I go in there and I just see this giant black furry mass, tail up, face down. I'm like, oh.
Again, at least that's not your kids.
If anybody wants a cat, let me know. I've got a really big one. She's very cute.
She's fluffy. She's heavy. She caused multiple figures of damage this year. But she's so cute. Oh, man, that cat. I love her.
You can have her.
Free used cat. No, thanks.
All right. Well, that was waxing prolific on a lot of pee.
This episode's already in the toilet. Let's bring on our guest, Jerry.
Today on the show, we are thrilled to bring on Reverend Gerald Hunter. As you just heard from how I introduced him, he practiced as a minister for 30 years. He's now retired and has the chance to write books. He has written 3 books about hauntings in Michigan, and he is working on his 4th. So as you can probably gather, he's had a lot of experiences. We are going to be hearing some of those stories today, dating back to his childhood, which got him into all of this to start with. So Jerry, thank you so much for being on the show with us today. I'm really excited to hear your stories.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Becky and Diana.
You're in Michigan, correct?
Yes, I am.
Is that where you grew up?
I did, yes. I actually grew up in Brooklyn, Michigan.
I understand the house that you grew up in was quite haunted.
Yes, it was.
Walk us through that. What was it like growing up in this house? Tell us about some of the first experiences you had and just lead us through your childhood.
Well, we moved to Brooklyn when I was very young. Brooklyn was only 1,200 people. We had lived in a nice suburb of Detroit. My dad was a police officer in that area, but then he took the chief of police job in Brooklyn in 1965. And matter of fact, he was chief because he was the only police officer. He moved us into a very old, pretty much run-down farmhouse. So it was a culture shock. And I can recall we moved in there in January of 65. So, yes, I've got neckties older than you two. And immediately, me and my 3 brothers, we were just, what has he done to us moving us into this place? There was a hand pump for water at the sink. There was an outhouse out back. And a wood-burning, coal-burning furnace in the basement. Now, we did have indoor running water, but the hand pump still worked. And we did have an indoor restroom, thank God. But the old one was still out there. It was very run down, threadbare carpets and light bulbs hanging from cords from the ceilings and those kinds of things. And your first impression was, if it's not haunted, it ought to be. That's how bad it looked. So after we moved in, the job that my brothers and I had was we each were assigned a week on a rotating basis to go down into the basement during the winter time with the coal bucket and get the ashes out of the furnace, take them outside and dump them. Whenever we would go down there, we would hear a baby crying, or we would catch glimpse of a man suddenly just standing in the doorway. It was an old Michigan basement, which meant dirt floor and stone walls. After a while, it reached a point to where we just didn't do the rotating basis. We went down together. And we would go down very quickly, gather up the ashes, run up the stairs, run out the back door, throw the ashes in the yard, and then throw the bucket back down the basement steps. Because it was that frightening. I mean, to look up and see a man at the other side of the doorway staring at you and then disappearing, listening to the baby cry. It didn't happen every time you went down, but enough to where we decided, no, we don't want to do this. Then I remember at first I shared a bedroom with one of my brothers, and I was scared to death of the clothes closet there. We would lie in bed some nights and listen to someone come up the stairs, because our bedroom was upstairs, and we could see a figure walk across the landing and go into a bedroom that was not occupied at the time and disappear. Eventually, we went to my dad, a very macho man, and told him what we'd been seeing and experiencing, and his response was, again, very macho, and that was, there's no such thing, knock it off, you're seeing things, you're making things up, those kinds of things. He was a very loving man, but still. And so we went to my mother, who was from Alabama and still had the heavy accent, and we told her. I remember she looked at us, and she said in her southern accent, she said, "Now, boys, they won't hurt you." And I remember thinking, oh my God, Mom sees them too. And it continued on. Eventually, I moved out of that bedroom and into the very tiny bedroom that used to be a storage room. where that ghost spirit used to walk into. I could lay in bed and see the stairway, and I could watch from time to time this dark figure of an older man dressed from what looked like the 1920s or 30s. He'd come up the stairs and he would stop and he would just stare toward the bedroom that I was in, and then he'd walk to another bedroom and go in there. Eventually, my older brother went into the service, and so I took his big bedroom all by myself. And I can remember lying in bed there and actually watching this man come through the bedroom door. Now, when I mean through the bedroom door, I don't mean through the doorway. I mean through the door. And then cross the room and go into that clothes closet. It was a very huge walk-in closet in this big old farmhouse. People say, how could you stand that? Well, it didn't happen every night. It happened just enough to remind you that you're not alone in this place. And it becomes your house. That's where you live. This sounds very strange, but there's a certain amount of normal to it after a while. I can remember getting up for school by the time I was in the seventh grade. I remember this happened for the first time in the seventh grade. I came down for breakfast. My mother usually slept in. My dad was an early riser. And I can remember more than once walking into the kitchen and seeing someone that I'd never seen before standing across the kitchen. And that person would look at me and I'd look at that person and they would turn and start to walk away and just fade out. We never saw the same person twice.
Oh, so in the kitchen?
Oh, yes. And in the living room and in the upstairs, and with the exception of that one old man who's checking on us every night. I can remember also, we only had one bathroom and it was in the main level. And I can remember there were a couple of times getting ready for school when I would be in the bathroom combing my hair and then I'd brush my teeth and I'd bend over and I'd raise back up and look in the mirror and I could see another face behind me. Then I'd swirl around real quick, you know, and it would be gone. That happened more than once. Later on, in early high school, we had a bunch of friends over. It was wintertime for a euchre party. And so we were upstairs in one of the empty big bedrooms and had some tables set up and music playing. Everybody was playing at their tables and those sorts of things. And then one of the girls there decided that she was going to take a break and just watch us. So she stood up and she was watching us, and all of a sudden she gave out a huge scream and took off running out of the room, down the stairs, through the kitchen, and out into the snow, refused to come back in the house. My mother had to go out there and calm her down. She said that she was watching us play, and she looked up into the dresser mirror, and there was an image of an old man standing next to her. And just out she went. She totally lost it. She refused to ever come back to the house. The same was true with relatives of ours from the Detroit area. They would come out to visit for the day, but they would never spend the night because things they'd experienced and that we had experienced. So it was a very interesting place. And then as an adult, I married Tracy in 1996. And I was going to take her to visit my mother. It was early summer, and my mother was living in the house by herself and had been for many years because my dad died back in 1988. I asked her one time, how can you stand living in the house all by yourself? And she said, well, I just told them they're welcome to be here as long as they don't frighten me. And I remember thinking, Mom, why the hell didn't you make that agreement when we were kids?
Right.
Anyway, I took her to meet my mother, and the way over to the house, I was thinking, should I tell my wife about the house being haunted? Because I didn't know how she'd take it. And I remember thinking, no, I won't tell her. Probably nothing will happen. It doesn't happen all the time anyway. We got to the house, and it was on a Saturday about 11 o'clock in the morning. And my brother was there with his wife, so it was the two of them and the two of us and my mother. And we were just sitting at the kitchen table having coffee and tea and cookies and just talking and having a nice visit. Well, just outside the kitchen door is the door that goes upstairs to the bedrooms. My wife had gotten up and went out of the kitchen to the living room to get her purse. As she came back, we heard and saw the knob of the door that goes upstairs start to turn. My wife saw it. She stopped and looked. We watched the door slowly open all the way. Then it came off, up off the old style hinges, went out into the floor, laid itself horizontal, and laid itself down on the floor, barely making a sound.
What?
I remember looking at my brother. He was 6'4 and 220 pounds, and he was shaking like a leaf. He grew up in the house too, you know. And I remember thinking, oh my God, is divorce in the area here? I didn't warn her. And I was looking at my wife, and she came walking back into the kitchen and looked at us and said, wow, that was great.
Yay.
Oh, right. My marriage is stable. And we visited some more, you know, my brother and I put the door back on. About a year later, my mother called me and she said that she was having the deck built. She wanted me to come stay at the house for a couple of days because she wanted to go visit a sister who was not feeling well back in the Detroit area. And she wanted me to be there for the guys who would be building the deck in case they needed something. So I would stay in the house for a couple of days by myself, is how that the plan was. The first night there, I decided I was going to set up my tripod and my video camera and have it pointed up the stairs toward the bedrooms. I went and I slept on the couch. And in the morning, I got up, had breakfast, and I hooked everything up to a video system and watched it and listened under headphones with the volume up to see if anything happened. I never saw anything. However, about 10 minutes into this, I could hear an old man's voice as clearly as you speak to me saying, hello, hello, hello. And then he recited, Mary had a little lamb. And at the end of reciting that, he said, ha, ha, ha. And I sat there in a state of kind of amazement and thought, okay, Jerry, just keep listening. You know, don't lose your cool. You've investigated hundreds of places. You know the place is haunted. Just keep listening. And sure enough, about 5 or 6 minutes later, the same old man did the same thing. Now, it wasn't an exact repeat. There were different inflections, different intonations, but he did the same thing. Hello, hello, hello. Mary had a little lamb, went through the whole thing, and then ha, ha, ha. And I kept listening. And a little while later, I could hear a whole bunch of what sounded like women talking in another room. But so often when you hear spirits talking, it sounds like that. It sounds like they're in another room and you can't really make out what they're saying. And that stopped. And then about a minute or two later, I heard a man's voice very clearly rise above other voices and say, whoever's going down there, meaning down the stairs, whoever's going down there, stay to the left of whatever that is, meaning my tripod and camera. So I, that was it. I got on the phone and I called my brother. He was also a police officer. And he came right over to the house and I said, you've got to listen to this. He listened to the first recitation from the old man and he just said, no more, no more, no more. Now he was standing there with a gun on his hip, he's a macho guy, and he left. So I had to be there for another day and another night. And so I figured, well, you know what? I don't want to sleep upstairs in the haunted bedroom again. I don't want to sleep on the couch because I have a bad back. So I'm going to sleep in the only downstairs bedroom, which was my mother's. And so I ran the recorder again and I crawled into bed. Now, my mother has, her room has solid French doors on it. That's two doors that you close together. And I closed those doors and I went in and crawled into bed and did some reading like I always do. And around midnight or so, I started thinking, this is really weird. I mean, what grown man sleeps in his mommy's bed? You know, but I figured, well, I'm in, so I'll, you know, better than going upstairs. I finished reading and I shut the light out. And as soon as I shut the light out, all hell broke loose. It was all kinds of scratching and pushing on those two doors, just banging and scratching. And then what was I can only describe as angry footsteps just going back and forth at the foot of the bed, back and forth, stomping. And on the dresser where all of my mother's perfumes and cosmetics and things were, it sounded like somebody was scattering them all over the place. And it was all of this happening at the same time. I have only truly been frightened after all the hundreds of places I've been twice in my life. And that was one of them. And I remember lying there listening to this. It kept going and going. And as crazy as this sounds, I actually fell asleep eventually. In the morning, got up and just decided last time I'm in Mom's room, had breakfast. And then I went back to the living room and went through the tape again, and there was nothing on it. Had my lunch, and then I went over to the living room because I wanted to try something that we had tried when we were kids. When we were kids, we would shout out for the ghosts to make themselves known, and we would have banging or we would have whatever. There were times we could knock on the wall and they'd knock back. Yeah, and this preacher here is telling the truth. I'm not like the guys on TV. So I went to the living room and I stood in the doorway. It also had French doors that were glass, but I opened them and I stood in the doorway and I looked into this cavernous living room and I just said, shouted out, "Show me that you're here." And instantly, everything electronic, the television, the radio, the VCR, the lights in the room, the lamps, everything started going on and off. Now, they weren't going on and off together. They were all doing their own intermittent light show, just going crazy. And I hollered out, "Knock it off," and it stopped. And I'd holler, "Do it again," and it would start up. This is pretty cool. I'm calling my brother again. He's got to see this. So I called him at work, and he shows up in his uniform again. And I said, "Remember the old days? Watch this." And I did it, and it started going, and he really got angry with me. And said, "I told you I don't want anything to do with this." And out he went. Well, fast forward a little bit to 2004, I think it was, and my mother called me. She had put the house up for sale. And she said, "Jerry, I sold the house." And I said, "Well, good, Mom." I said, "Who'd you sell it to?" And she said, "There's this wonderful young couple with a couple little kids from Ann Arbor, and they're so excited." And I said, "Mom, did you tell them the house is haunted?" And she said in her beautiful little Southern accent, "Why, no, I didn't want to frighten them." And I thought, "Okay, Mom." Well, they took possession of the house, and my mom was moved into an apartment that she liked. And she called me about 3 weeks after they moved in, and she said, "Jerry, can you take me over to the old house? We left some dishes there in the dishwasher, and they want us to come pick them up." And I said, "Sure, I'll take you over there. I'd love to see the old house again." And so we went over there, and it was in the evening, and we sat in the kitchen at the table, and we were talking and chatting about this and that. And in my line of work, I've discovered that the last thing that people tell you in a conversation is generally the most important. Well, after we'd been there about a half an hour, my mother said, "We had best hit the road. It's getting darker." And all of a sudden, the young woman just blurted out, "Before you go, can you tell us who died in the bathroom and who the people are upstairs?" And I thought, well, let's sit down. Their children had been seeing an old man upstairs who would watch them play. And they had actually encountered someone, I got to put this delicately, they had encountered a body lying on the bathroom floor more than once. They would open the door and it would be there, then it would disappear.
Oh no.
In 1988, my dad had gone to bed and gotten up to go into the bathroom and had a pulmonary aneurysm and bled to death in the bathroom. That's where he died.
Oh no.
And when I asked him to describe what he looked like, they described him to a T. A balding man. He was in his 60s. He had on a pair of blue jeans and a white T-shirt. That's how my dad always dressed after he retired. And so I knew that they had seen him. They lasted about 2 years and sold it. And then that couple that bought it, lasted another 2 or 3 years and sold it. Now another couple is in it. They put it up for sale twice, but for some reason backed out both times. And I'm waiting for it to go up for sale again because I seriously would consider buying it.
Yeah.
I grew up in the house and I have believe it or not, I have a lot of good, warm, wonderful feelings about the house. A lot of good memories, Christmases and vacations and people coming over and those kinds of things. So it wasn't all bad. And I would like to take people who say there's no such thing to come visit my old house.
Yeah, that will change their opinion.
But that house is the reason why I decided I needed to find out what was going on and why I pursued world religions, myth, dreams, fairy tales in my college days and in my seminary days as well. And at seminary, people found out that I was interested in these things. And I had a colleague of mine. When you're in seminary, they give you a church to take care of, usually a small church. My church, however, was like 100 and some people. But at any rate, a colleague of mine came to me and said, Jerry, you are interested in these things. And I have some people in my church who insist their house is haunted. Can you help them out? And I said, well, yeah, I can help them out, but why don't you help them out? They're your parishioners. And he said, I don't believe this stuff. He said, I'm not into this stuff, but if you want, you know, they want some help. And I said, well, I'll go. I said, how about tagging along so you can introduce me to them? He said, I'm not going to that house. I thought you didn't believe in this. And he said, well, I don't believe in it, but I still don't want to be around it. And I said, well, okay. So I had to go over there by myself. And that house was in Worcester, Ohio. It was built in the 1820s. That investigation I did with a friend of mine who was also a graduate of Annapolis Naval Academy. We spent several days and nights in that house, some of them alone. And it was one of the most haunted places I've ever been in. This guy was nasty and mean. During the daytime, we just normally relax, get comfortable with the house, and then we do a walkthrough and we take photos of each room for inventory purposes. And I want everybody to know I'm not messing with their stuff. We started taking the photos and we went upstairs. We went to the master bedroom. We stood in the doorway and we took photos there. And the master bedroom, the people that owned the house had put all kinds of antique furniture and antique paintings on the walls that were hung with ribbon and nails. Just beautiful work they did in the whole house to make it look like an old-time farmhouse, which it had been. So we took photos there, went down the hallway, took photos of the other rooms, and then we were walking back to go downstairs. And as we passed the master bedroom, my buddy John said, Jerry, look. And we looked in the master bedroom, and now the bed coverings are on the floor. All the drawers are open. The paintings are hanging awkwardly. Everything's just a mess. And so we're thinking to ourselves, how do we explain that we didn't do this? We went downstairs. We just left it like it was. We got down there and we put a little soft music on a kitchen radio just to meditate and have that in the background. 3 or 4 times while we were sitting there listening to the soft music, the radio station would just roll through all kinds of other stations and end up on a rock and roll station. And we'd have to turn it back and it would go back again. Then we noticed that both of our wristwatches had stopped at exactly the same time. Just little things that were going on. But I could see it was starting to bother John. So we did some recording on a cassette player and asking questions, 1 knock for yes, 2 knocks for no. And we actually got several responses. After a while, John looked at me and said, Jerry, I got to go to the bathroom. I said, well, okay. He says, no, I have to go and I need you to go too with me. And I said, well, okay. And so, you know, women go to the bathroom together. Men don't. Right? We have no desire to do that. We walked upstairs to the main bathroom, which used to be in the old days a nice-sized bedroom. There's a door off the hallway that goes into the bathroom, but there's actually a walkway that goes into the bathroom. And then you turn right, and it opens up into the bathroom proper. So I told him, all right, John, we're here. You go on in. I'm staying out here in the hallway. You do it. He said, leave the door open. All right, I'll leave the door open. He went in and he did his business. And then he came over to where the towel was. I could see looking down that little walkway that there's a towel there, but a lion's head with a hook. And he took the towel off and he dried his hands and he put it on the hook and he started walking toward me, and the towel flew off past him. And when men get really, really scared, they don't scream, run, cry. They try to cover it by showing anger. So he just blew up and started hollering at that ghost and grabbed the towel, and he went over and he tied it in a knot on that thing. And he said, "That'll keep you messing with me." And he started walking out and it flew past him again. So we ended up going back downstairs, sitting there and talking about all the things that were going on. And he said, "Jerry, the next thing that happens, I'm waiting for you out in the car." So about 3 weeks later, the people called and said, "Can you come over for the night again? Things are acting up again. Can you come over for dinner with us?" John wasn't going to go back, so I called my nephew, who was also a cop. He drove down from Michigan to Worcester, Ohio, just for this. And we had dinner with these folks, and they had one other woman, a friend of theirs, over. And we had a very nice dinner. And then they said, "Well, let's do the investigation." I said, "Okay." The owners of the house, the man went upstairs and sat at the top of the stairway where he could look down the hallway where a lot of activity happens upstairs. And the two women broke out a Ouija board down in the living room. Yeah, I don't mess around with those. It's not because I so much that I think that it conjures up spirits or whatever, but I'm convinced that what we believe affects what happens to us. And if you have a strong belief in that, who knows? So anyway, they broke the Ouija board out and they were going to use that. And so David and I sat down on the floor just to watch them in the living room, and they had candles going. I don't know why people think they have to have the lights out, candles going to investigate a haunting, but I guess a little effect for the mood doesn't hurt. And so we were sitting there watching, and they would ask questions and the thing would move. And you don't know if it's power of suggestion or what. So we sat there and David and I watching, and we're taking things with a grain of salt. But then two or three times, both of the women, they would have their fingers on the planchette and they would let out a little, like a small scream, and back off, and the planchette would move by itself several inches. And then about the third time that happened, they screamed and let their hands up, and it went back and forth the distance of the board and then off the table. They just said, "We need to calm down. We need to stop and just calm down." And so they did. They said, "We're going to close our eyes and meditate and center ourselves." And we said, "Okay." You know, about 2 or 3 minutes into their meditation, David pokes me and says, "Uncle Jared, look." And we looked over, and coming out of the kitchen was this kind of slow, swirling, wide, thick white mist that was about 2.5 feet off the ground and very long. And it came swirling towards us, and it came swirling past us, and you put your hand in it, and it was very cold and a little electric feeling. And then it wafted through the room and went off into another room. Now, the two women never saw it, which is probably a good thing. When they were done meditating, they said, "Let's turn the lights on." And she called her husband down from upstairs. And they started all very excitedly saying, "We contacted the spirit. We contacted the spirit." And his retort to that was, "No joke." He says, "I've been up there watching her walk back and forth up and down the hallway for the last 40 minutes. And he said, "It is a woman. She was from around 1900. Says she had a dark green velvety dress on. She's crying, and she just walks back and forth, back and forth." Now, they'd seen her before, and their teenage kids had seen her before. David and I spent a lot of time on the internet and going to libraries down there in Worcester, doing title searches on the house. And we noticed that nobody really stayed in the house very long. And we would call people who had lived in the house before, and they would either hang up on us or tell us we're full of crap or whatever the case might be, until we got a hold of one older woman who had lived there for a few years in the 1950s. And we asked her, "Did you ever experience anything strange there?" And she said, "Oh, my God, am I glad you called. I thought I was the crazy one." And she told us that she'd been seeing the same thing. We did discover, by pulling up old newspapers and things, that back, and I think it was around 1912, there was a man there named John who owned the place. He had a wife, just the two of them. And from what I understand, he was a difficult man to get along with. They described him as stout, a short-cropped red beard and red hair. He owned the farm, but he also owned businesses. And we discovered that he had gone to the East Coast on a business trip. This is back in the early 1900s, so that's a big event. And he was gone for nearly a year. And when he got back, he discovered he was the father of a newborn daughter. Well, we kept doing our research into all of this and discovered that the baby died from a fall down the stairs before it was even a year old. And that the woman jumped out an upstairs window. Now, the upstairs window for the main bedroom is on top of a hill, and there's a big drop-off, and she committed suicide there. The family has often seen this man who actually taunts them. I have not seen him, but I knew he was there because when he shows up, there's this strong stench of sweat, and you just get the feeling that you're not in a good place. I finished up seminary and moved to Michigan, and I decided I was going to write a story about those experiences. And as soon as I decided that, he started showing up at my house. And so I just cut a deal one night. I didn't know if he was around or not, and just said, all right, I won't write your story if you just stay the heck out of my house. And I never had the feeling or sense that he was around again. Eventually, I did write the story. I just figured, the heck with you, you're not going to intimidate me. I wrote the story, and the Akron Beacon Journal made it the cover story for their Sunday news magazine. And when I moved back to Michigan after seminary, people had read that, and word got out of what I did, and that led to all of the ghost hunting that I did, because this was back in 1987. And I've done work for the city of Detroit. I've done work at historic Fort Wayne Army Barracks on the Detroit River that was built in 1848 and seen full body apparitions there. One thing leads to another and people call. Now what's happened lately, though, is when I first started doing this, people would contact me. I never contact others. I never call places and say, do you think you have a haunting, whether it's a business or whatever. They contact me and then we make arrangements and I do questionnaires and things like that before I even go. When I first started doing this, people really were reluctant to talk about it. And when I would go to their homes or their places of business, they would even say to me, please don't tell anybody. Because back then it was like a stigma. Nowadays it isn't. It's all over television. It's all over social media. And every little town has at least one ghost hunting group. God bless them. I appreciate they do, that they're interested in all of this. But I just caution them, don't go in with your mind made up. You know, don't think that every time a mouse cuts loose with a little gas that it's a ghost, okay? Try to disprove things.
So how did you and your brother end up with such different opinions or approaches to spirits and the paranormal growing up in the same situation? Because it seems like you relish the experience, whereas your brother attempts to avoid it at all costs. And then the other brother didn't seem really on board either.
Yeah, there's a couple of reasons. One of them is all three of my brothers and my dad were very macho men. And macho covers up a lot of insecurity. And I'm not macho. And always wished I was. The other reason is because when I was about 5 years old back in 1957, so now you know how old I am, yes, I hate being the same age as old people. I was 5 years old, and I remember I had an extremely high fever and was lying on the couch in the living room. I remember it perfectly. It was a white vinyl couch and a turquoise painted walls. It was the 1950s, after all. And back then, you got sick. Nobody went to the doctor. I remember I was covered up with a heavy blanket, and my mother was very worried. And I was so sick that even at the age of 5, I didn't care what happened. It was horrible. And the fever was so high. My mother, to her dying day, said that my temperature was 107. Now, doubt that it was that high, but it must have been pretty high for her to remember it that way. But I do recall that all of a sudden, I was no longer on the couch. I was up near the ceiling, and I was looking at myself on the couch. And I could also see at that time my mother and father going into a panic. And I'm watching myself on the couch, but at the same time, I can see my mother in the other room getting on the telephone to call my grandmother in another city nearby. I could see my grandmother in that city answering the phone. I could hear their conversation. I could see my dad in the bathroom drawing cold water in the tub to immerse me in it. I watched as my mother finished that phone call, and I could see her call my uncle who lived down the street, who was a male nurse, and I could see him running toward the house. And I'm up there watching it all, feeling perfectly fine. The best way I can express it is, if heaven is a place where everything is simply okay, that was heaven, because I was okay. There was no fear, no panic, nothing high, nothing low, just this okayness, calmness, all peace. And I'm watching this. And then all of a sudden, I'm not at the ceiling anymore. I'm in this, what is like a tunnel. Now, all of this is, what I'm telling you is juxtaposition of opposites, I know. But I'm in this tunnel that's pitch black, but you can see everything there. And at the end of the tunnel, way down there, is this light that was brighter than the sun, but it didn't hurt to look at it. And I never felt so warm, so loved, so okay in my life. And I started just going toward that. And as I was going toward that, there are people lined up every few feet, and they're relatives of mine. I just knew it. I mean, I'm 5 years old, but they're older people, and I knew they were relatives of mine, and they're smiling, they're welcoming, it's just a wonderful feeling. And then all of a sudden, one of them says to me, "You got to go back." And like that, I was back on the couch, the fever broke. I can remember a couple of years later going to school and trying to tell schoolmates about it, and they made fun of me, so I never told anybody about it at all. Until I was in my early 20s and I went to visit my mom, and we sat down at the kitchen table in that old haunted house and got the big box of family photos out. And I said, "Mom, you know, when you're gone, nobody's going to know who these people are. So we're going to sit here and just eat oatmeal cookies, drink tea, and write the names of the people down." And she said, "Okay." And every now and then she'd lay a picture down and I would say, "That's Aunt Eunice." "Oh," and I go, "That's Uncle Paul." And eventually she looked at me and she said, "How do you know who they are? They all died before you were born." And in a couple of instances, one of them had died before she was born. And I finally had to tell her what was going on and what had happened to me. And her response was, "Oh, you too." And I said, "Me too, Mom?" And she says, "The same thing happened to me and happened to your grandmother." And I thought, well... But since then, I've never had the fear of death. I'm afraid of how I might die. I don't want to be in all kinds of agony, but I've never been afraid of it. That's been so helpful in my career. And I know that this isn't the only life. So that gets back to your question, Diana, what's the difference between me and them? That may be part of it.
That was so Michigan of you. Heaven is a place where everything is just okay.
Yeah, that's Michigan, all right. Yeah.
I love that.
When you went with your mom to visit the new owners of the house and pick up the dishes, and they described your father to a T as being there in the house, how did your mom react to that?
My mother was fine with it. My mother was one that really never showed a lot of over-the-top emotion. She was always very calm, loving, soft-spoken person. I don't believe I've ever heard her say a cuss word in her life. I do remember that she sat there okay with it and explained to them that was probably my dad. And I explained to them, "You're not the only one that have seen things upstairs. They never hurt us. I mean, they'd scare the daylights out of us sometimes, but they never hurt us."
So your father died in the bathroom in 1988. And then your mom lived in that house and you were visiting that house on the regular for at least another decade.
Yeah.
Is it odd to you that he never appeared to you, but appeared to this new family he didn't know?
He has appeared to me, just not at that house. He's appeared to me twice. Once I was in my car and I was in the little village of Brooklyn and I stopped at a stoplight and I looked over at the car next to me and it was him. And the light changed at that instant and I had to go. Then the other time I saw him at my house. He just walked in the room and smiled and was gone.
That brings to mind another question. In your speculation, why do you think in your childhood home you had the one guy who lived in the closet in your brother's room and then just a bunch of random visitors?
I'm no expert, and I always tell people when they ask me questions that there are no paranormal experts. We're all people just trying to figure out what the heck is going on. But after doing this for 40 years, I come to my own conclusions, and I could be dead wrong, but the conclusion I had was that there's one spirit there that for some reason others are drawn to. And people use words like portals or whatever. I don't know. Maybe that's it. But I do know that that one spirit is there all the time. And it sounds like my dad hangs around because I've had other people tell me they've seen him in the window. But the other ones coming and going, it's almost, in my mind, like the spiritual power or energy or comfort or whatever, they're drawn to that. And they're there and they're gone. That's the best I can do for you.
So he just had a lot of house guests over, basically. The ghost guests of the guy in your closet.
Well, to this day, I still have bad dreams about the closet. As recent as last night.
And do you think that was his voice singing Mary Had a Little Lamb?
I don't know, but it was just a very old man's voice.
Any relevance of the song? Does it mean anything to you or your family?
Mary Had a Little Lamb?
Yeah.
Just that it would be a kind of a rough birth for her.
Nice.
No, the feeling I got from it when he recited it twice was when he would go ha 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 at the end made me feel like he was really saying I am here, that kind of thing. And I have no idea how many spirits are crawling around that place. I know enough to where it keeps going up for sale.
Well, hopefully one day you're able to acquire it.
I hope so.
Well, Jerry, this has been wonderful to talk
intense.
To you, and a great cover of stories that you have and an amazing life of experiences that you have to go along with it.
We'll link to your books too so people can buy them or read them online. Yes. on our website when we post this.
Please tell us the names of your books.
The names of my books are Haunted Michigan.
They're all called Haunted Michigan?
Okay. Are you ready for this? The first one's Haunted Michigan. Okay. Uh-huh. The second one is, this is creative, more Haunted Michigan. When we got ready to put the third one out, I told the publisher, you are not naming this even more Haunted Michigan. We came up with something different. And the fourth one is going to be Confessions of a Ghost Hunter.
Cool.
I feel like I've read Haunted Michigan when I was living in Chicago. You said the fourth book is on its way?
Yes, it should be out this summer.
Excellent, excellent. Well, we will include links to Haunted Michigan, More Haunted Michigan, and Haunted Michigan 3, The Haunting Continues, on our website on homespunhaints.com. Jerry, this has been a real joy to listen to. Y'all have been listening to Gerald Hunter, author, paranormal investigator, retired minister, and an amazing storyteller. Thank you so much, Jerry.
Becky, Diana, you guys take care of yourselves.
Thank you, Jerry. Thank you. To our listeners, Haunted Loves, wow, have a spooky day.
Homespun Haints is hosted by Becky Kielimnik and Diana Doty and produced by Homespun Haints Media, LLC. Editing and music by Becky Kielimnik. Show notes by Diana Doty. If you have a ghost story and you'd like to be considered as a guest for this podcast, please visit our website at homespunhaints.com/submit.